Reason doesn't always apply. Reason doesn't always answer a question. And sometimes, as one of my favorite comics has pointed out, if you could laugh at it, you could live with it.
That's Al Genie, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Al Genie is a professor of business ethics and the author of numerous books on issues in contemporary American culture. For over 27 years, he's been the resident philosopher on Chicago's public radio station, WBEZ. And he can also be heard on WGN in Chicago. He joins me to talk about his latest book, The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. Al, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with the subtitle of the book. Why do we need more jokes in our lives?
Well, that's the giveaway question, but because life is difficult. Life is confusing. Life is at times absurd. Life is unanswerable. Life is irresolvable. And life is unavoidable. So we have to do something about it. And I think very often, and I don't want to get too heavy-handed here, reason doesn't always apply. Reason doesn't always answer a question. And sometimes, as one of my favorite comics has pointed out, if you could laugh at it, you could live with it. And I think that's an important part of life, the ability to both try to understand life, but when we totally can't, at least to laugh at it a little bit.
You point out that your uncle and many others have said that humor is a means of sort of defense and offense.
Yeah, I think, can I talk a little bit about my Uncle Joe?
Because please do.
He's the reason we're here. About certainly right after the 13th century vowel shift, when I was a young boy, I had this wonderful man in my life, this alpha man, my Uncle Joe. And every time I saw him, until the week before he died, he would grab me in his arms just before the imbrazio, just before the kiss. He'd whisper in my ear, "Did you hear the one about?" And he never, or rarely, if ever, told the same joke again. And as I grew older, the jokes grew, a little more adult-like, et cetera, et cetera. And it was just wonderful. He always made me laugh. But somewhere in my teenage years, I pushed back. I said, "Uncle Joe," and this is all in Italian, "Che cosa fai? Why are you doing this? This is silly. Why are you doing this?" He looked at me and said, "Alfredo, are you stupid? If I didn't love you, why would I want to make you laugh? If I didn't love you, why would I give you the gift of jokes, the gift of humor?" And then he went on to explain that, humor defangs the terrible things in life. That if we could laugh with it, we could live with it, and if we could endure it, it's a bit of a defense against the universe. And I've lived with that the rest of my life. And then I found out as an adult that my Uncle Joe's favorite comic, Mel Brooks, said the same thing, that joke telling is a defense against the universe that we can't always understand. And it isn't an escape. It isn't an answer, but it's a safety valve.
In your book, you talk about the history of humor. What are some of the earliest examples of jokes in written history?
Well, as my students will tell me, were you there? No. About 2,900 years ago, the Egyptians had a hieroglyphic for laughter, which suggested something. And I am convinced that some unknown Egyptian comic somewhere along the line, after he made fun of the rising and falling of this river in front of them and the strange shape of the pyramids, probably made fun of the Pharaoh's mummy. I'm sorry. But, there was a joke there. Mm-hmm. And I think people were joking all the time. And then, you find it in the Bible. You find it in Genesis where Abraham and Sarah and Isaac are visited by an angel, or certainly not Isaac yet, because he wasn't born yet, and the angel of God winds up being God himself and says to them, "You shall have a child." And Sarah says, "You got to be kidding. I'm old. We're both old. We don't even have sex anymore. It's not possible." And God reveals himself to them and says, do you mock in life? And God says, No. I didn't realize it was you, Lord. I thought you were just kidding. And then they wind up having Isaac. And by the way, the Hebrew derivation of that word is laughter. Which is kind of interesting. So perhaps the first joke is in Genesis, which I always take to be a charming little fact.
One of the other things you point out is that throughout a lot of history, there have been court gestures and fools. And this has shown up in many different cultures because they served a very important purpose.
Yeah.
Tell us about
There's a wonderful book out there by Beatrice Otto, O-T-T-O, which she talks about the role of gesters, the role of buffoons, if you will, not buffoons in the negative sense, but the clowns in court life. And it's not just Europe, which we probably know more of, you know, walking around with a little hat, and it's on the cover of my the jacket itself. But rather, Cheyenne had people called contraries who were able to say things. The Chinese, the Indian groups, across human experience. And I think they came out of the ruler's loneliness, the ruler's need to have someone say something. Who knows? Because it's clouded in mystery. But the jester had the right to say funny things to the king. Now, they had to be in costume. They had to be in outfit, if you will, so it was clear. They were able to say things that, as Otto talks out, that Socrates or Seneca couldn't have said to the king. In fact, you know, what people don't realize is Plato opens a school for politicians and went to Syracuse, for example, went to Syracuse and to and Sicily to help the king establish rulership. And Plato said too many things, and he had to make a quick exit, you know. And I think that these clowns, if you will, became this acceptable outlet. I think they became the safety valve, the social Claxton of the community, the night criers in the community that can only exist there. Later, many of them became very important within courts, but I think their primary purpose was to break the tension of the moment.
And that is still a very important function today.
And I would suggest that modern social media certainly does that more and more, but modern social television, cable TV, certainly demonstrates that. I mean, Jon Stewart changed the show, the Daily Show on at night, from kind of a smarty pants social commentary about, you know, topical cultural issues, et cetera, to a serious satirical review of the news, not fake news. He never talked about fake news, but fake analysis of the news. And that spawned, think of the people Jon Stewart spawned, think of the people, what Bill Maher has done to satire in America, that he gets up there and he snarls at it, but this is serious satire. This is not, if you will, a Robin Williams notion of satire of making sure that your jokes make it clear that the Pope farts. This is serious satirical analysis. And I think that that's a safety valve for us. And clearly, no matter what you think of Mr. Trump politically, no matter what your political, you know, commitments, Mr. Trump is just a lightning rod for satire. We have four people at night basing all of their comedy on national TV shows on what Trump and the Trump administration have said that day. You've got John Oliver once a week doing it. You've got The Daily Show now with Trevor Noah doing it every single night. You've got Saturday Night Live just winning, you know, I think an Emmy Award for the best interpretation or a mimicking of the president. So I'm not talking about reviling the president, you know, really attacking him as a person, but reviling his issues. This is the role of humor. I think this is the role of satire, to make fun of, but in the process, perhaps learning a great deal about it as well.
Mm-hmm. And the thing about satire, at least a lot of satirists, is no one is safe. Everyone is fair game.
Right, right. And that's the real understanding of satire from the Greek is to bite one's lips, to bite one's cheeks, to be so angry. And from Jonathan Swift, that nothing should be safe. Everything is open for criticism. And that makes it kind of fair. So everyone is open for criticism. And I think the wonderful comic who did that beautifully with President Obama, I've forgotten his Greek name. It's from the Fern Show. He had the Fern Show. Can you help me?
Zach Galifianakis?
Zach Galifianakis, whatever it is. I'm so sorry. Kind of a brilliant. And so he's asking the president questions, you know, and he says to him, well, how's it feel to be the last black president of America? And the president looks up and says, how's it feel to be the last president you'll ever interview? Boom, ba-da-boom, boom, ba-da-boom, right? And it's wonderful. Now, the president did a number of comic interviews. Mark Maron, for example. Because he said, that's where the young people are listening. That's where I want to get to. And he had a wonderful sense of humor. His last presentation at the dinner with the newspaper people in Washington, he was funnier than all the comics. Now, he had great writers, but he had great delivery. You know, he has great timing. But I think, you know, he used humor kind of as a little leverage. He always started with a little story or pointed out, oh, I'm in Boston. I understand you got a pretty good football team and had a pretty good baseball team. This human touch, and I think that's, remember what humor is. that we can laugh at ourselves and laugh with others. And that's a little bit of a bonding principle. In fact, I think when you tell a joke, if we had just met at a radio conference and I told you a joke at the appropriate moment, what I'm really offering you is a little gift saying, and do you get it? Oh, that means we think alike. There's a little bonding principle between us. But if you don't like my joke, assuming it's an appropriate joke, I'm going to wonder a little bit about you. And you're going to wonder a little bit about me as well. I think satire now is at a different level. And I think that satire now is very, very in-depth and in detail. And in some sense, contemporary satirists are a combination of George Carlin, or George Carlin is a combination of Dirty Talk, you know, that was a part of it, that came out of Lenny Bruce, and that Mort Saul, who really took, you know, you had to have a PhD in political theory to understand his commentary. And so it's right there. And so Carlin said, comics, just like the court jesters, have an obligation to tell the truth and speak truth to power, and that they're out there doing these things. And we've given comics great license, and television has allowed them to have great license, right? You turn on cable, well, those seven deadly words are no longer deadly words. They're used all the time, and so on and so forth. And so we have great license to do that, but it's got to be a license with a limit. And I think the perfect example of that is, 2 points, Alec Baldwin doing this wonderful satire, this wonderful mimicry of the president. And by the way, Saturday Night Live, from the beginning, you know, made fun of Jerry Ford, Chevy Chase, and then all the way through, one of the male actors always acted out the president. And then to Kathy Griffin, which is a bridge too far. She went too far. And so there has to be a certain limit, you know, holding up the severed head and saying something about Mr. Trump. That becomes a question of impropriety. And so I think that humor does have limits. You have to know, what's the three rules of real estate? Location, location, location. I think the three rules of comedy are audience, audience, audience. But there's one other element, if I may. And I think that we have to recognize the fact that unethical jokes, racist jokes, misogynist jokes, anti-Israel jokes can be funny. Have the right meter. Boom, bada boom, boom, bada boom, ha ha ha, right? Set up, delivery, pause, boom, punchline. But it doesn't mean you should tell them. It doesn't mean they're acceptable. It doesn't mean they're right. But unfortunately, if you're a Nazi in 1938 in Berlin telling really outrageous anti-Semite jokes to a Nazi crowd, you're going to get laughs. But the question really becomes, there's a difference between is a joke funny and is a joke ethical? And that's one we just have to deal with as a society.
You write in your book that we're living in perhaps a new golden age of comedy.
Yeah.
And
Is
part of it just because it's so available, or what would that be your reason for believing that at this point?
Yeah, I think availability is a big factor. And I mean, I want to go all the way back to I mentioned Saturday Night Live. It's 40 plus years. It's a giant on TV. It's created a whole culture of comedy. Even though they do skits, look at the people that are alumni of that group. They go on to have whole comic careers, both as stand-ups and as comic actors. And then with cable, with Jon Stewart, with Bill Maher, now with John Oliver, Samantha Bee, et cetera, et cetera. And Stephen Colbert, you know, who's now had two iterations of himself, one playing the conservative, now playing the liberal, okay, which he says is closer to who he is. I think there is an explosion. I mean, you want a list of jokes, just go to the internet. You want to see any comic from 30 years ago, you know, Google them, and there it'll be available to you. I do think there's a media availability that's really real, but I think people really want to laugh more nowadays. I think people need to laugh more nowadays. And I think the laughter is closer to home. I think my parents, when they laughed at Bob Hope and Jimmy Durante and during World War II, they just wanted escapism. And so they told jokes, you know, as jokes. Milton Berle, et cetera, George Burns. But comics today are observational comics. It's still a joke. Let me give you an example. I think clearly Seinfeld is a logo for a program that is now, you know, kind of classic American, but he himself did observational comedy. But there was still a joke in it. There was a setup, a pause, and a conclusion. And here's my favorite Jerry Seinfeld joke. You know, I never knew my voice had a tone until I got married. And off, you know, and off you went. Or you talk about checkbooks, or you talk about third date or fourth date, whatever it might be. These people, I think, are little barometers of cultural awareness, are critics of cultural awareness. And like the jesters, they are the town criers for the issues right now. Frankly, about 27% of people under 35 get all of their news from some of these fake news shows. Not fake, again, not they're not fake news, they're real news, but fake analysis shows, the Jon Stewart, the Oliver, so on and so forth. And they can make the difference between the joke and the fact, and that's an interesting phenomenon.
Al, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Al Jeaney's latest book is The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. More interviews on a wide variety of topics are available at kpr.ku.edu/conversations. You can also use our KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.